Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome once again to the Hour of the Time. I'm your host, Robert Houghton. Tonight we're going to begin the H.G. Wells New World Order book, reading from this book. It's 144 pages long, so we anticipate it to be run over several episodes of the Hour of the Time. We used to sell copies of H.G. Wells' The New World Order. I consider it a pretty good background piece for any researcher that's interested in how long these ideas have been around. Now, if I look at the copyright date on this, it was published sometime during World War II, as you'll tell by the text here, but it doesn't seem to have any sort of copyright date on it. We'll be reading the complete work. 1939 and 1940, there we go. We'll be reading the complete work from top to bottom. So if you'd like to start your tape recorders now, this is definitely a piece worth keeping. We will be offering these tapes for sale as soon as the series is completed. Now we're going to pretty much get right into the reading of this text. I'd like to just give out our website address. It is hourofthetime.com. Once again, that is hourofthetime.com. You may write to us directly to me, Robert Houghton, at webmaster@hourofthetime.com. If you'd like to get a hold of Doyle Shamley, you may write to him directly at hourofthetime@hotmail.com. If you're interested in helping to support this program, we definitely need your support. You can go and check out all the different products that we have for sale. There are a couple of new Bill Cooper videotapes available. Please go and check those out on the website. Once again, that's hourofthetime.com. Or you may write to us at HOTT, H-O-T-T, P.O. Box 940, Eager, Arizona, 85925. We will be glad to send you a list of our materials. H.G. Wells, The New World Order. What will happen in Europe and to the whole world when the present war is ended? There will be a revolution. That is obvious, Mr. Wells says. Following a consideration of those factors which make it inevitable, he concludes that such a revolution must be along socialistic lines if civilization is to survive. But the New World Order which Mr. Wells suggests may be a world socialism scientifically planned and directed, with insistence upon law based on restatement of the rights of man and complete freedom of speech, criticism, and publication. This can be attained, he is convinced, only if each one of us is equally certain that it can, and each will work now towards realizing it. And no sane man can make a better beginning in that direction than to read this book. Chapter 1. The End of an Age. In this small book, I want to set down as compactly, clearly, and usefully as possible the gist of what I have learned about war and peace in the course of my life. I'm not going to write peace propaganda here. I'm going to strip down to their framework certain general ideas and realities of primary importance, and so prepare a nucleus of useful knowledge for those who have to go on with this business of making a world peace. I'm not going to persuade people to say, yes, yes, for world peace. Already we have had far too much abolition of war by making declarations and signing resolutions. Everybody wants peace, or pretends to want peace, and there is no need to add even a sentence more to the vast volume of such ineffective stuff. I am simply attempting to state the things we must do and the price we must pay for world peace if we really intend to achieve it. Until the Great War, the First World War, I did not bother very much about war and peace. Since then, I have almost specialized upon this problem. It is not very easy to recall former states of mind out of which, day by day and year by year, one has grown, but I think that in all the decades before 1914, not only I, but most of my generation in the British Empire, America, France, and indeed throughout most of the civilized world, thought that war was dying out. So it seemed to us. It was an agreeable and therefore readily acceptable idea. We imagined the Franco-German War of 1870 to 71 and the Russo-Turkish War of 1877 and 78 were the final conflicts between great powers, that now there was a balance of power sufficiently stable to make further major warfare impracticable. A triple alliance faced a dual alliance, and neither had much reason for attacking the other. We believe war was shrinking to mere expeditionary affairs on the outskirts of our civilization, a sort of frontier police business. Habits of tolerant intercourse, it seemed, were being strengthened every year that the peace of the powers remained unbroken. There was indeed a mild armament race going on, mild by our present standards of equipment. The armament industry was a growing and enterprising one, but we did not see the full implication of that. We preferred to believe that the increasing general good sense would be strong enough to prevent those multiplying guns from actually going off and hitting anything. And we smiled indulgently at uniforms and parades and army maneuvers. They were the time-honored toys and regalia of kings and emperors. They were part of the display side of life and would never get to actual destruction and killing. I do not think that exaggerates the easy complacency of, let us say, 1895, 45 years ago. It was a complacency that lasted with most of us up to 1914. In 1914, hardly anyone in Europe or America below the age of 50 had seen anything of war in his own country. The world before 1900 seemed to be drifting steadily towards a tacit but practical unification. One could travel without a passport over the larger part of Europe. The postal union delivered one's letters uncensored and safely from Chile to China. Money, based essentially on gold, fluctuated only very slightly, and the sprawling British Empire still maintained a tradition of free trade, equal treatment, and open-handedness to all corners or to all comers round and about the planet. In the United States, you could go for days and never see a military uniform. Compared with today, that was, upon the surface at any rate, an age of easygoing safety and good humor, particularly for the North Americans and the Europeans. But apart from that steady, ominous growth of the armament industry, there were other and deeper forces at work that were preparing trouble. The foreign offices of the various sovereign states had not forgotten the competitive traditions of the 18th century. The admirals and generals were contemplating with something between hostility and fascination the huger weapons the steel industry was gently pressing into their hands. Germany did not share the self-complacency of the English-speaking world. She wanted a place in the sun. There was increasing friction about the partition of the raw material regions of Africa. The British suffered from chronic Russophobia with regard to their vast appropriations in the East, and set themselves to nurse Japan into a modernized imperialist power. And they also remembered Majuba. The United States were irritated by the disorder of Cuba and felt that the weak extended Spanish possessions would be all the better for a change of management. So the game of power politics went on, but it went on upon the margins of the prevailing peace. There were several wars and changes of boundaries, but they involved no fundamental disturbance of the general civilized life. They did not seem to threaten its broadening tolerations and understandings in any fundamental fashion. Economic stresses and social troubles stirred and muttered beneath the orderly surfaces of political life, but threatened no convulsion. The idea of altogether eliminating war, of clearing what was left of it away was in the air, but it was free from any sense of urgency. The Hague Tribunal was established, and there was a steady dissemination of the conceptions of arbitration and international law. It really seemed to many that the peoples of the earth were settling down in their various territories to litigious rather than a belligerent order. If there was much social injustice, it was being mitigated more and more by a quickening sense of social decency. Acquisitiveness conducted itself with decorum and public-spiritedness and was in fashion. Public-spiritedness was in fashion, rather. Some of it was quite honest public-spiritedness. In those days, and they are hardly more than half a lifetime behind us, no one thought of any sort of world administration. That patchwork of great powers and small powers seemed the most reasonable and practicable method of running the business of mankind. Communications were far too difficult for any sorts of centralized world controls. Around the World in 80 Days, when it was published 70 years ago, seemed an extravagant fantasy. It was a world without telephone or radio, with nothing swifter than a railway train or more destructive than the earlier types of HE shell. They were marvels. It was far more convenient to administer that world of the balance of power in separate national areas, and since there were such limited facilities for people to get at one another and do one another mischiefs, there seemed no harm in ardent patriotism and the complete independence of separate sovereign states. Economic life was largely directed by irresponsible private business and private finance, which, because of their private ownership, were able to spread out their unifying transactions in a network that paid little attention to frontiers and national, racial, or religious sentimentality. Business was much more of a world commonwealth than the political organizations. There were many people, especially in America, who imagined that business might ultimately unify the world and governments sink into subordination to its network. Nowadays, we can be wise after the event, and we can see that below this fair surface of things, disruptive forces were steadily gathering strength. But these disruptive forces played a comparatively small role in the world spectacle of half a century ago, when the ideas of that older generation, which still dominates our political life and the political education of its successors, were formed. It is from the conflict of those balance of power and private enterprise ideas, half a century old, with these ever-growing disruptive forces, that one of the main stresses of our time arises. These ideas worked fairly well in their period, and it is still with extreme reluctance that our rulers, teachers, politicians, face the necessity for a profound mental adaptation of their views, methods, and interpretations to these disruptive forces that once seemed so negligible and which are now shattering their old order completely. It was because of this belief in a growing goodwill among nations, because of the general satisfaction with things as they were, that the German declarations of war in 1914 aroused such a storm of indignation throughout the entire comfortable world. It was felt that the German Kaiser had broken the tranquility of the World Club, wantonly and needlessly. The war was fought against the Hohenzollerns. They were to be expelled